Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guests this week are Roelof Botha, a partner at Sequoia, and Peter Kolis, the co-founder and chief executive officer of Ethos Life. These are two separate conversations on the future of insurance technology, among other topics. Roelof is an investor in this space, and Peter's company is an online life insurance startup focused on disrupting the life insurance industry by providing a frictionless and more affordable life insurance package. In this interview, Roelof talks about what has made insurance tech an attractive segment to invest in. We also talk about his take on artificial intelligence and voice technologies, why he was determined to immigrate to the United States, and a variety of other topics. With Peter, he notes that most life insurance companies are 150 years old, if not older. He acknowledges that that history provides advantages of capital and customer bases, for instance, but his company, Ethos, is relying on its speed of execution and digital advantage. We also discuss how Ethos is using behavioral science and product testing for ease of use, as well as a variety of other topics. Roelof has a long track record of success as his investment portfolio consists of companies such as YouTube, 23andMe, and Square. And prior to Sequoia, Roelof worked at PayPal after graduating from Stanford Business School. Prior to founding Ethos, Peter was the co-founder of Ovid Corporation. Enjoy this interview.
Well, Roelof Botha, welcome. It's great to speak with you today. It's a pleasure to meet you, and I appreciate you taking time with me.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure, as I say. Roelof, I thought we would begin with your own sort of investment philosophy. And I know from our earlier conversation and from some research and things that I've read about you that you you don't consider any single swim lane to be your own. You have a diverse diet, a diverse area that you cover in terms of companies and topics that you investigate that interest you. These include present and past companies that you've invested in or on the board of, including 23andMe, Bird, Evernote, Unity Technologies, MongoDB, Square, YouTube, etc. Just that list alone shows quite a bit of diversity in the way in which you think and invest. And I wonder, without sort of a focus on B2B versus B2C, industry, for example, how do you think about the investments that you make? How do you think about what areas to meander into, to investigate, to think about where there is good opportunity for you and for your company as an investor?
I'd say it's a combination of top-down thematic thinking and trying to think about how the world might look differently 5 or 10 years from now. And then bottoms up, meeting with founders and having them articulate their story. There's nothing like sitting with an entrepreneur and having them explain why they came up with the idea, what was their eureka moment, what frustrated them, what was the problem that they confronted that they wanted to go solve, and then having them articulate why they think they came up with a distinctive value proposition to solve that particular problem. And so it's a combination of those two things. Sometimes there's a theme that I think is interesting and you don't find the team necessarily that you think can take advantage of that. And part of what I love about this business is I walk into a meeting every day and somebody surprises me with an insight on an industry or a problem that I was just blissfully unaware of. And it's fabulous to dive and delve into that problem with them and have them explain why it's an interesting problem space.
So I know also from your education background is as an actuary, Roelof, and I know you have said that has given you a perspective to think well into the future from an investment perspective. Can you talk a bit about how you leverage that longer view in the way in which you reflect upon investments?
So my professor said this when I was a first year actuarial science student. He said, actuaries are trained to think 25 years into the future and accountants are trained to think 1 year in arrears. But it was funny at the time. And the reason it's relevant for actuaries is if you're selling a life insurance policy today, you may need to pay out on somebody's ultimate death, decades from now. And you need to think very carefully about how you price that product? What are the premiums you're charging for the life risk? How do you model the expense structure of the insurance company over that time period? How do you plan to invest the premiums until you need to pay the claim? So just it requires this very studious thinking about how things compound and change into the future. And a lot of what's interesting in the technology investment area is the fact that things compound. You know, the famous Moore's Law, just this notion that things change far more quickly than you can anticipate. My bet is that if I told most people 10 years ago, including myself, that there'd be a car driving itself the way that we now see in the roads by many different providers, I would probably not have believed you. I would have thought it's many decades still into the future. And so it's part of the training is thinking about how things compound in ways that will surprise you. You know, the human brain didn't evolve for compound interest to be natural and intuitive for us. And often when we look at a company, you know, we look at the way the world works today, and you listen to a company's articulation of how things might be different. You know, when we listen to Square initially, and it turns out that there's still 20 million merchants in America that don't accept credit cards in the 21st century, it sort of strikes you as, huh, that's kind of odd. Can't imagine the future should be like that forever. And so can this company actually help bring that future forward? I mean, that's a lot of what our founders do ultimately is they have a vision for tomorrow and they help bring the future forward. And that's part of the fun of being in this job.
I have another discipline that hopes to look to the future and think about risk and spreading that around in an appropriate way by attracting a great number of customers and spreading risk throughout the policies that they dictate is the insurance industry, an industry you've done some investigation in, as well as one in which you've made investments in. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what attracted you to that space and specifically to an investment that you've made there.
Sure. So the thing that's interesting in the investment business, we often joke that the industry you came from before you became an investor is typically the one that you avoid after you become an investor. Sometimes because you know too much about the industry, sometimes because you're just curious to learn about other new areas. And so I trained as an actuary and I worked in life insurance companies before I ended up coming to the United States. And so I hadn't thought of it as a great investment area for us necessarily. The internet had arrived and it disrupted distribution for many different businesses. But 20 years into the internet, despite broadband, despite mobile devices everywhere, insurance is still largely sold the way it was sold 50 years ago, which is through in-person agents. That accounts, I think, for over 99% of life insurance policies sold in the United States. And there are over 10 million of these policies sold every year. And so it wasn't intuitive or obvious for me that that industry was ready for disruption. And then I met Peter and Linky, you know, to the point I made earlier in the conversation about meeting a team and sort of seeing bottoms up that they came up with a great idea. I met these two founders who just had a fresh take on the opportunity, a distinctive approach at going about solving this distribution conundrum where, you know, young people today probably want to buy an insurance policy in 5 minutes on their mobile device where they're in control and they don't want to be sold a policy by an agent they may not trust. And it's the fact that they just thought about it differently from the way I'd heard it expressed by any other founding team that really got us excited and made us want to partner with them at the seed stage, actually. So we've been investors in the company for quite a while.
And can you talk a little bit about what it is, you've talked about this, just the way in which consumers, as they're rising, the younger generation, as they get to the age where it's appropriate to contemplate life insurance, that to some extent the solution they have developed fits more into the way in which that demographic is comfortable, that they prefer not to purchase from somebody that they don't trust. They prefer not having a process that takes weeks and doctor's visits and blood tests and all these sorts of things. Can you talk a bit about, as you peel back the onion on this opportunity, as you learned more about the founding team and their vision for this, what are some other things that compelled you about it?
So what I'd seen from most other businesses was an attempt to bring online distribution to life insurance without changing anything else in the product. And if you think about the early days of e-commerce, it was, I think, somewhat similar. It was but it wasn't really innovating fundamentally with what you could do with online distribution. And so if I'm trying to market to you online, but you still have to fill out, you know, tens and tens of pages of information, you still need to have somebody come to your home or your office to do blood work and sort of a full physical exam. That's just so much friction, and the benefit of online distribution just isn't all that meaningful, honestly. And I've, you know, I've twice been through that process of getting life insurance in the US and having to set aside 2 hours in the morning and, you know, the stress of all these tests, and it's so cumbersome and time consuming. And the reason this team was different is they said, to solve this problem, we have to do a lot of hard work that isn't just about trying to market something online. It's actually fundamentally changing the product and digging into the technology, doing a partnership with, you know, securing a partnership with a reinsurer so that we could reach very deeply into their technology stack so we could change the way that the product fundamentally works. And this is where the pairing of Peter and Linky was so interesting, because, you know, Peter had background in the insurance business. Linky was a technical co-founder, and he's the CTO of the company. He writes a lot of the software and runs the engineering team. It's not just a business innovation, it's also a technical innovation of reimagining that product, because you can't get a 5-minute application process on a mobile device without the need for blood work if you haven't done that product integration into the reinsurance company. And that is fundamentally the hard work they were willing to do, which I think opens up an ability to deliver a much lower cost insurance solution and a seamless online experience. And by the way, that also opens up online distribution that has been untapped until now. If you think about that model where people had to buy an insurance policy through an agent meeting them in person, that precludes all these wonderful online distribution ideas. So you mentioned earlier that I'm on the board of 23andMe. Well, I'm not sure if this is going to happen, but if 23andMe wanted to offer life insurance as an additional benefit to some of their subscribers, or to, you know, to market to them that they should get life insurance, they can't do that with any of the existing providers. But Ethos enables them to do that. So it opens up really interesting new partnership distribution potential.
Very interesting. And part of the reason for traditional insurance companies to go through the battery of tests is to assess the risk that they are taking with each policy that they're writing. And by reducing this, on the face of it, it would seem as though the company is actually taking on potentially more risk. How does it get around having so much data to be able to have a clearer picture, at least from their perspective, as to the sort of the risk that they're assuming without the battery of tests that the traditional life insurance organizations undertake?
Yeah, it's a very good question. There's this great thing in the insurance industry called adverse selection. Insurance companies do no underwriting for annuitants, mm-hmm. and they do a tremendous amount of underwriting for people who take out life insurance. And despite that, annuitants' life expectancy is better than insured lives because of adverse selection. It's a really interesting insight. So part of what you have to understand is with a traditional model, because it's sold through agents, agents have an incentive to get commissions. And so insurance companies are battling a sort of fundamental adverse selection process, not just from the people who are seeking life insurance, but also from the agent networks that are trying to push policies through, often helping fill out the form for the proposed insured, because they know what the underwriting policies are, and they'll do what they can to make sure that this person's policy gets issued. And so there are a lot of just, you know, attributes of the existing distribution system that leads to adverse selection challenges that aren't just solved by doing the physician's exam. So that's one challenge that I just want to put out there, that it's not as though it's not that easy in the existing distribution channel. Mm-hmm. And then the advantage that Ethos has with its online distribution is it can think very creatively about where to market to potential users, and they can be very circumspect in their funnel of how to identify good risks to take. So getting back to that 23andMe example from earlier, if you're the sort of person who signs up for 23andMe, you're probably interested in your health and your wellness. You're interested in your family. As you know, in general, people who are more connected to their families have better life expectancy than people that are loners. So my guess is, on average, 23andMe's customer base is actually a better pool of risk I don't know that for sure, but it's a fair guess. But it gives you the sort of insight that Ethos can tap these pools of users online with very targeted advertising or targeted distribution channels that can end up with very good risk profiles for the lives that they want to underwrite. And then I will say that the company has done a really good job of developing online underwriting mechanisms that are very good proxies for risk, short of having to do an actual blood draw. One of the interesting insights we had at PayPal was you could prevent shrinkage at your store by building a brick wall in front of your front door, but then you also have no sales. And there's this really interesting balance, because we had this challenge at PayPal and many of the other financial services companies we work with of fraud and how much money you lose to fraud. And it turns out that if you make it very hard for all users, you make it a little bit harder for the fraudsters, but the fraudsters will get through anyway. But now you've disproportionately turned away good users. And so while you may have less fraud than if you'd had a less stringent process, the mix is different and you actually have a higher fraud rate. And there's an analogy for me here with insurance where Ethos makes it easy. And so it's not just the people that are desperate and probably bad risks who make it through your application process. There are a lot of good risks that make it through. And that's the balance that you need to strike between good risk and bad risk.
Interesting. You mentioned that Sequoia tends to think about investments in terms of themes or landscapes, and that you personally try to think about trends or new technology areas to investigate. What are some other ones that you're beginning to contemplate here as we sit here in the late stages of 2018?
Wow, that's a big question.
Yes, I mean, I don't need a comprehensive answer, but maybe a couple of things that have you excited as you think about it today.
Sure. Let's think. Voice interfaces. I know people have written about this a lot over the last year or two, with the sort of devices that are making it into our households these days with Google Home and Alexa and Apple's product, the Pod. We think there's a lot of runway for voice, not only for consumer applications, but also in the enterprise. Security, it feels like an evergreen theme. It's sort of the proverbial arms race of bad guys trying to find new ways of taking advantage of us, all the way up to nation states and their attempts to steal IP or break into systems. Privacy is obviously a huge thematic shift that we've seen over the last 12 months with what's happened with Facebook and Google, et cetera. And so we're paying attention to that. I wonder whether it leads to a set of new consumer services that are different. You know, maybe there are new social networks that are going to start up that are a lot less open than the ones we've become accustomed to. We don't know, but clearly there's a shift taking place in privacy that I think is interesting to pay attention to. The rise of machine learning and artificial intelligence, I think, is a big one. A twist we have on that is we like to think about augmented intelligence, the way in which machines and people work together to be more productive rather than just machines replacing humans. Gary Kasparov, the former chess champion, talks about that a lot and how the arrival of machines and chess programs have actually helped elevate the game of chess players because it's man plus machine.
When you take a theme like that, Roelof, where there are implications today for companies to leverage, but there's also so much that is years in advance. You think about the difference between artificial general intelligence, for example, versus the by comparison more rudimentary AI that's in process now that we're already feeling the impact of. How do you think about the difference between the two as an investor who's looking to make a return in the relatively sort of near to medium term? I imagine you're looking for companies that have practical commercial applications of what they are doing. But to what extent are you also looking for those who are have a bigger vision that can connect itself sort of to the promise to come that may be sort of decades in the making?
Mm. It's a tough one for us because it's so we're far more patient than I think most people might appreciate for what it's worth. It's been interesting for us when we have some of our companies go public and they're the so-called long-term buyers in the public market who buy at the IPO or they buy shares after the IPO. And it turns out that oftentimes those people are sellers of the company's stock even before we've distributed. And obviously we've been a shareholder of the company many years prior to that. So my guess is for companies of ours that go public, the average time that we're an investor in the company is probably 8 to 12 years. So we're far more patient than I think most people may appreciate. That said, we don't think our business is funding research. It's more funding development. And fundamental research is obviously an incredibly important underpinning to U.S. economic growth. It's part of why U.S. productivity has been such a consistent source of economic growth for the U.S. I mean, that's productivity growth is why the U.S. has become a rich nation. It's because ideas and technology has enabled the U.S. to grow on average about 0.5% to 1% per annum faster than many of the other industrialized countries. And so research is critical. That's why things like the National Science Foundation or the work that's done at universities is so, so crucial. And if you look at the big tech companies, they obviously have enormous budgets for R&D. And specifically, I mean, they're doing a lot on the research side. So I think it's super important, and I spend my weekends reading science books because I find that stuff fascinating. But our investments, as you point out, have to be grounded in things a little bit more near-term development focused. I'd say we typically don't invest in a company that isn't within about 2 years of being able to ship its product to customers. So we'll sometimes make an investment in a security company, an enterprise storage company, something of that ilk, where there maybe is an 18, 24-month development cycle before first customer ship. But if something is sort of 5+ years beyond the horizon, that probably isn't a good investment for us, just given our fund construct. And then the judgment we have to make is, given exponential growth, which are the things where we misjudge, where we think it's 7 years away and it turns out to be 3 years away. and so that's a tricky balance. Anyway, I'll stop there.
Yeah, no, it's great. Those who are listening to this will no doubt detect your South African accent. You're an immigrant to our country, having grown up, born in Pretoria, grew up in the suburbs of Cape Town to a prominent family. Your grandfather was a foreign minister to the country, your father an economist. What was it that drew you to the U.S.? Yours is a company that is famously not only made up of a number of investors who are immigrants to the U.S., but also so much of Silicon Valley, actually, some Silicon Valley companies, that is, has a founder or two who grew up or spent meaningful time outside of the U.S. before immigrating here. And I'm always curious for people who've made their pathway to the U.S., what it was that attracted them.
So I think in general, the U.S. is just so attractive to talented people around the world as a place that is about meritocracy and where immigrants, at least traditionally, have been welcome. And it's very hard for me to imagine any other country in the world where someone can go where they aren't a native, they don't necessarily speak the language. I mean, English is my second language. And where you'd have the sort of opportunity to integrate into society and to have an opportunity to excel in whatever field, whether it's academia or business, everybody has an opportunity to excel. I don't think there's any country in the world that can rival the U.S. in that regard. And so from my point of view, I thought about, might it be interesting for me to go live in Europe? And I actually worked for a summer in the United Kingdom. And it was just palpable that it was not the same as being in the U.S. I mean, this truly is the land of opportunity. And so that's part of why the U.S. to me made sense. And my grandmother had, a Time magazine lying around the house in the mid-90s. And I read this article about Stanford University, and it lit up a light bulb for me. I applied to go to Stanford. I was lucky enough to get in. And it seemed as though, and this was, I applied in 1997 and got to the U.S. in 1998. And it just... To go to Stanford Business School, yes. And it just seemed as though Silicon Valley was this fountain of opportunity. There were so many new businesses being created here, such innovation technology, a wonderful bridge to Asia. It just seemed like a place I needed to get to. And honestly, when I got to the U.S., I didn't even know what venture capital was. I never knew I'd be in this job. I didn't think I would join a startup company like PayPal, which I did right out of business school. I just had an intuition that I needed to get here. And if I could get here, I would find more opportunities. It was one of these open up a door that might lead to more doors and more possibilities down the road. That was really the intuition. Not particularly well planned out.
Though it's worked out pretty well for you.
It has, you know, the advice I often give younger people is, at least when I was, I mean, I came to the US when I was 23, it's very hard to have a 5-year plan when you're 23. I mean, you know, and so what I try to do is just figure out if the next decision you're making is something that opens up possibilities for you or one that shuts down opportunities for you. And to think about decision processes early in your career in that way.
That seems like great advice. Well, Roelof, it's a pleasure to make your acquaintance. I appreciate you taking time with me today, sharing a bit about the way in which you think about your own personal investment portfolio and landscape, the landscape more generally speaking. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you very much.
Peter Kolis, welcome. It's great to speak with you today. I appreciate you taking a little time with me.
Well, thank you for having me, Peter. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Peter, I thought we'd begin with your role as CEO and co-founder of Ethos Life, a company you founded just a bit over 2 years ago, based in San Francisco, an organization that has really caught quite a bit of momentum, both in terms of the investor community that has invested in it, as well as, of course, more importantly, as the precursor to all of that, the business that you were developing. I thought I'd give you a moment to just sort of talk a little bit about the business, as well as maybe if you can take me back to its founding, what was the problem that you were looking to solve in creating the business?
Yeah, absolutely. So we started Ethos, my partner Linky Wang and I, while we were roommates at Stanford Business School. We were getting our MBAs, but I had come from a background of advertising, and Linky had come from a technical background. He's a very talented computer scientist. And we originally got interested in a different aspect of life insurance and learned a lot about it. And what we came to understand was that life insurance was incredibly important. More than 5% of kids in the U.S. are going to lose a parent by the time that they're 18. And 70% of families are so unprepared that if they lost a breadwinner, they would be in total financial ruin within 3 months, implying that Americans are very unprepared for the loss of a breadwinner. And so as important as life insurance is, we realized that it's executed quite poorly by the existing industry. And we saw an opportunity to dramatically improve how it's executed with technology. And so that's kind of the premise that we were trying to solve. Life insurance is an excellent product, but it's executed very poorly. Ethos is a modern and ethical life insurance company. So while the traditional life insurance experiences this kind of 15-week morass of pushy agents and paper applications and medical exams and blood tests, Ethos is simply different. You go to our website, you fill out an application online in 10 minutes, and then you're done. There are no medical exams, no blood tests, no paper applications, no pushy agents. And so we launched earlier this year, and we're now processing thousands of applications each month and look forward to continued growth.
And why do you suppose it has been executed so poorly? It is a business that has been around for an awfully long time. It's a very successful business as well. A lot of great companies actively involved in it. And so you know, check that box also. But what are the issues from your perspective?
Sure. So two things. One is the product itself is very difficult to get. And so if you want life insurance, you kind of have this 15-week morass of a process where you have to go through this agent who's incentivized to sell you the largest and most expensive policy they can. And you'll fill out these paper applications, you'll get medical exams, you'll get blood tests. And at the end of it, you'll get this price that's much higher than you were originally quoted. But you've gone through this invested process. And so you're either going to get this policy or you're going to gamble your family's future and not get it. And so that's one part, is it's very difficult to purchase. The second part, though, is a overall problem of incentives, which is a life insurance agent is compensated to sell you the largest and most expensive policy possible. And what that entails generally is something called permanent life insurance. Permanent life insurance is often an investment feature product that costs 20 times as much as term life, which is the best option for most families in America. And so agents like to focus on selling permanent life insurance because their commissions are 20 times as much. And they usually focus on selling it to people who can afford it, wealthier families, or people who can't afford it but are unsuspecting or who they can convince to purchase it. And what we figured out was 87% of people who purchased those permanent life insurance policies would lapse them or surrender them, losing or forfeiting a huge amount of the value that they put into it, and their families getting nothing. And so those were kind of the two big issues that we wanted to solve. One is this kind of old janky process, and the second one is one of products that are designed to enrich agents and companies at the expense of individuals.
One of the reasons, or I should say another of the reasons beyond the ones that you've noted for the length of the process is a desire by the companies to, as best as possible, evaluate the risk that they're insuring, thus the battery mm-hmm. of tests to determine how healthy the would-be insured is. Beyond sure. the sort of the easier things to understand in terms of age and weight and height and all those sorts of things. How do you get around some of those things? In some ways, that seems very prudent, understanding, you know, what the life expectancy based on some data and based on, you know, actuarial tables and past customer sort of experience and these sorts of things. How do you, in having a faster process, which no doubt is pleasing to the insured, how do you do so without assuming too much risk in the process?
Sure. My overall perspective is that, life insurance is a highly considered financial purchase, and most highly considered financial purchases today have an excellent digital solution, whether it's Oscar Health for health insurance or Rocket Mortgage for mortgages or Open Door for selling your home. There are all these excellent, truly digital solutions, and that's kind of what Ethos is to life insurance. Life insurance underwriting hasn't changed in 50 years since blood tests became big. And the way that we do it is algorithmically underwriting somebody's life expectancy based on supplementary data. So what does that mean? It means using data to be able to verify if somebody's telling the truth to us or being forthcoming about whether it's their behavior or their health information. And then the second is being able to use data to predictively model for somebody who looks like you in your situation, what's your expected risk of passing away during a certain term length. And so it's a very precise science, automated underwriting, but it's all for the benefit of the consumer and being able to offer them a policy instantly online with the hope that people who otherwise wouldn't purchase a policy will.
Interesting, Peter. Can you talk a bit about the way in which you've thought about digital experience, the role that technology plays in this? There is, again, as we talk about the traditional way in which this is done, a very tactile, analog way of doing business. You know, think about the mountain of documents you need to sign, the battery of tests, again, all things that are done typically in person. Can you talk a bit about the way in which you've thought about the digital versions of each of those analog experiences and, again, sort of simplifying things for customers and would-be customers?
Sure. We're students of behavioral science and product testing is what I would say. So, we want to maximize for a couple things. One, we want to maximize for ease of use, so making it faster and cheaper and better. And then the second thing is we want to maximize for people disclosing everything that they should throughout the process. And that's, been a large prevention to carriers in the past. Carriers are completely dependent on life insurance agents for 100% of their policies. Ethos going direct to consumer online, we don't have the benefit of meeting our customers. And through that, we need to figure out how to get them to be very transparent with us. And so we study how do we ask certain questions in certain ways that make people feel comfortable being forthcoming with us. And what we found is that our customers are extremely honest with us when we do retroactive data studies. We found out that that we've built a brand. It starts with the brand where people feel comfortable engaging with the brand, ask things in a way that doesn't put people off and doesn't seem intimidating. And then, you know, if they do want to speak with somebody on our team, being really approachable, letting them know that we're not here to sell them a policy, that no one on our team is commissioned or will profit from them as a customer, that we're really there just for their own well-being, and that we truly care about putting their family first.
What drew you? You've talked a bit about the problem you looked to solve and the fact that there was a problem, in fact, to be solved that was part of what was attractive to this. But what drew you to the industry, generally speaking? As you talked about, fairly sleepy one, a fairly antiquated one relative to many. Maybe that's the answer, is that the disruption had not yet happened. But I'm curious, what was the original impetus to get into insurance?
Sure. So it was an intersection of a few things. The first was, as I mentioned, the product itself is truly good. So we thought by doing what we're doing, we'd have an opportunity to better the world. The second is, it was an attractive market, both because it was large, but also because of the industry incumbents are very slow to move, is what I would say. By nature, they avoid risk. That's what their jobs have depended on for a long time. And life insurance carriers aren't these kind of adapt and very aggressive companies in the same way that like Allstate and Geico are in, you know, respective property and casualty insurers. They're quite different. And so we liked the competition, but then furthermore, we liked that the competition was totally dependent on agent channels and that they had this channel conflict and could not go direct to the customer. New York Life cannot go direct to the customer. They are dependent on these agent channels, which have served them well for a very long time, but in this digital age, make it very difficult for them to adapt. And so we knew that we would have a long lead time against people who have infinitely more amounts of capital than us. And so relying on kind of our speed of execution and technology instead of massive amounts of capital.
How have you developed your team? How big is your team? What roles have you hired for? I'd be interested in how you thought about that.
Sure. Today, I think we're 35, and we're growing quickly. I think we'll be 50 or 60 in the next few months. You know, there are kind of two core parts to our team. The most core part is engineering and product. So we're a very product-focused company. We put most of our effort into building an excellent customer experience. That could be something that the customer sees on the front end, or it could be on the back end, as far as automating some processes or figuring out how to make things more enjoyable. We put just as much effort into the back end as we do the front end. And then the second part is, growth. And so you don't want to only bring a product solution to a customer acquisition problem. And so we think a lot about who should we be reaching out to as our customers? How can we get them comfortable with Ethos? How can we potentially educate them on life insurance? One of the most interesting things about our business is the vast majority of customers that we process are people who were not looking for life insurance. They're people who are good candidates for life insurance, but they were not actively seeking it themselves. And we approached them and, you know, through some sort of medium and said, this is life insurance. This is the value proposition. This is Ethos. And, you might be well suited for it. And we found that the non-hard sales method is working quite well for us because we have an excellent product.
You also have an excellent group of investors, the likes of Sequoia, Accel, Google's venture arm GV. Interestingly enough, you also have a number of like Jay-Z has invented, invested, Kevin Durant has as well. I'm curious actually how you thought about the makeup of both your investors as well as the board that you've developed.
Sure. Yeah, you wouldn't expect Jay-Z to invest in a life insurance company.
Right, but, exactly.
I think one common thread through all of our investors is they really identified with the problem that we were trying to solve. We said, hey, we know life insurance is not sexy. We have no delusions that there are probably cooler companies that have approached you for an investment. However, it's incredibly important. It's fallen very far behind. Consumers suffer because of it, and we have a solution that can be game-changing and become build a market-leading business, build an enduring business. We said a great life insurance company has not been built for 150 years. New York Life, MetLife, Northwestern Mutual, these companies are all about 150 years old. And that's the way the industry is structured. And so we're up against great competition, but the opportunity could be very large. So that's kind of the common theme that ran through all of our investors. Our largest investors are Sequoia and Accel, they're wonderful partners. We couldn't be more pleased with our investment partners.
Excellent. You talked about some of the growth that you're anticipating from a people perspective. Are there aspects of your strategic roadmap as you look to the next year, two, three that you can share? Where do you see how else do you see the company growing other than the people you hope to bring in?
Yeah, absolutely. So the market that we're in today allows for a lot of growth just with our current product. And so I think for a while, we're probably just going to be focused on just continuously getting better at what we do and helping more and more families. And then I think the next step for us is we're building trusted relationships with people because we have a great product and an ethical kind of foot forward. And with this, what other products can best serve these same customers? They might be related to life insurance, or they might be totally different. And so we have some ideas about what we would do. The thing that would dictate what products we launch is, for us, the product needs to be ethical in that it can't be like us monetizing our customers or doing well at the expense of our customers. And then the second thing is, the leap from the traditional industry experience to our experience that we would bring needs to be as great as the one that we've brought to in life insurance. So we want to continue innovating using technology to really build a better customer experience in additional products.
Excellent. Well, Peter Colas, thank you so much for joining me today, sharing some perspectives on the company that you're growing. Congratulations on your success to date and best of luck in the future.
Thanks so much, Peter. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me next week when my guest will be Diana McKenzie, the Chief Information Officer of Workday.